Good morning. The passage from the New Testament is today from the book of Revelation, chapter 21, verse 5. And the one sitting on the throne said, "Look, I'm making everything new." And then he said to me, "Write this down, for what I tell you is trustworthy and true." Having heard the passage from Genesis, early in the Hebrew Bible, to this very near the end passage of the book of Revelation in the New Testament, gives one pause to reflect, I think. The view of God expressed in the story of Abraham and Isaac is one of the hardest theological perspectives to work with ever, I think. I find it quite reprehensible, as a matter of fact. To suppose that God would ever demand of any human the sacrifice, a human sacrifice, of an only son, bespeaks to me a deficient view of God. But the story also has a story of newness in it. What was anticipated gets transformed, and suddenly a ram is available to replace Isaac. We often hear the words in Methodism, "Let us unite the two so long divided, knowledge and vital piety." It's sometimes mistakenly attributed to John Wesley, but Charles is the one who actually said it. And I'm going to be working from and with that quotation a good bit today. "Behold, I'm making all things new." After being ordained an elder in the Methodist Church in 1959, I chose to become a university professor. And beginning in 1963, I was reappointed 39 successive years by the Bishop of the Conference to serve in the Department of Religion. Now, I'm not presenting that brief comment about my resume seeking a new career today. I did that. I am, however, saying that for having been a professor that long, my natural tendencies are to teach and to lecture for 50 minutes. Now, I promise not to do that today, but that's my natural tendency. I can't help it. As a professor of religion, I had a responsibility and an opportunity and a privilege to learn and teach the history, the organization, the beliefs, the practices, the ethics of many different faith communities. And we people called Methodists may remember that ours is one of the few denominations that actually began in a university, Oxford, where the brothers John and Charles were students in the 18th century. While at Oxford, they organized a group that they called the Holy Club. Other students derisively characterized them as Methodist. They were so disciplined and so traditional in the daily practices. Instead of taking offense, however, the brothers accepted the name Methodist as a designation of one particular way of being Anglican. In fact, both of them later became ordained Anglican priests and remained such until they died. They agreed, however, to have the leaders in America to refer to their church as Methodist rather than Episcopalian or Anglican for a variety of reasons, and the name Methodist stuck. Today, there are well more than 30 denominations that have the word Methodist or the name Methodist in their names, and the United Methodist Church is the largest of them. When Martin Luther set the Protestant Reformation in motion in the 16th century, he declared that Christianity was founded on two things: sola scriptura, scripture alone, and sola fide, faith alone. The Wesley brothers affirmed both of those as foundational. In their careers in England, after some unsatisfying time in the American colonies for a brief period, they devoted themselves vocationally to particular practices such as preaching in open fields, to gatherings of sometimes 30,000 people. Imagine it. Without a benefit of technology and a microphone, John Wesley, 5 feet 4 inches tall, speaking with a voice sufficiently strong and clear to be heard by 30,000 people in the open air. Quite an amazing and remarkable thing. Particularly coal miners as his audience. And he repeated that practice over and over as he rode what has been estimated as 50,000 miles on horseback in the course of his career. Charles wrote and sang hymns, composing the words and often the music of well over 6,000 different hymns. I think in our current Methodist hymnal, there's something like 150 of the hymns contained in it that were written by Charles Wesley. The founders of the Methodist movement emphasized that engaging in theological thinking is essential to being Christian. And that's the topic that I'm focusing on today. What does it mean? Well, one way of characterizing doing theology is to say that it is faith seeking understanding. That's a way of characterizing it that St. Anselm in the 11th century chose to put it. He reminds us that while the heart may claim our allegiance, we are called to use our mind and reason to explore, to think, to seek, to understand with the best of them, enlightened by grace, to live out the faith of our hearts. Now, Methodists have long propounded the view that the theological task should call upon four distinct resources: scripture, tradition, experience, and reason. In the 1950s, Dr. Albert Outler, a professor at the Perkins School of Theology at SMU, in affirming the importance of utilizing those four different resources, coined the term the Wesleyan quadrilateral. And it's depicted in a number of different images, in a square with scripture at the top and reason and experience and tradition part of that square. You can think of it in many different ways, but to do the Methodist way of theologizing enables or requires us to call upon all four of those as we move in our work. Another of the major emphases in many Protestant traditions, including Methodism, is something called the priesthood of all believers. One of the implications of that is, and we practice it in Methodism, is that there's no single authority within Methodism, no pope, no archbishop, no church council, which can definitively decide what doctrines we must adhere to. And some will say the book of the discipline does that. But that's not really a theological doctrine. It's a book of laws and practices and behaviors that SPRC committees are supposed to look into, for instance, and so forth. We have no required doctrinal beliefs. We have in the discipline reference to some of the ancient creeds, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, but when is the last time we have used those here in this congregation? Been a while. So, we have to do our theological searching ourselves. Nobody can do it for us. We do it with fear and trembling, but do it we must. So, Scripture, the first. It's the centerpiece of the traditions to which we turn. It's my conviction that every reading of Scripture is an interpretation. That is, when we read, we are engaging in an imaginative encounter with texts that were written hundreds, often thousands of years ago. What insights can be found when we read and respond to passages in Scripture, employing all manner of different approaches to the Scriptures? One of the most significant dimensions of what is often called progressive Christianity these days is a determined effort to engage the Bible in new ways. Martin Luther did that in the 16th century and started the Protestant Reformation. The Wesleys did it in the 18th century and moved things in a different, albeit continuous, way. I subscribe to an online journal that's called Patheos. In one of its most recent issues, there appeared a forum on the topic, Rediscovering Scripture for the 21st Century. 10 influential pastors and scholars contributed to that forum. And one of the participants in it, a pastor of a very large church, Brian McLaren, offers these words. The Bible, and the same can be said for the Quran or any other sacred text, is too good and too important to be left to those who won't think critically about it. It's too good and too important to be left to those who will not think critically about it. As a lifelong Methodist, identifying with progressive Christianity as I do, I affirm that interpreting Scripture with the assistance of tradition, experience, and reason, the other legs of the quadrilateral, is part of the theological way of being in the world that we who call ourselves Methodists have committed to do. By contrast, with regard to the Bible, many theologically conservative Christians believe that the Holy Bible, often the King James Version, is inerrant. That is, everything in the Bible is true, just as it was given, and there cannot be anything in it that is wrong or mistaken. That view is frequently combined with the view that the Bible may and must be literally interpreted. From that perspective, the Bible must never be questioned, but rather must be submitted to. One of the central affirmations of many progressive Christians, in stark contrast with that literalistic, inerrant view, is that people do and must interpret the Bible, and that the context text and circumstance of the interpreter at any given time will inevitably provide new insights and understandings. Reverend Dr. Robert Hill is a practitioner of this orientation toward the Bible, as he so powerfully demonstrated last Sunday from this pulpit in his sermon, Love in Mind. In mind was what he worked on so extensively and so remarkably. Scripture is the cornerstone. Tradition is the first way we interrogate Scripture. Bible study is deepened by learning from 20 centuries the way Scripture has been interpreted within and among different Christian traditions. Learning that fact leads to the realization that the number of such interpretations is in fact legion. So that appealing tradition really means referring to the library of traditions of interpretation, if you will. Referring to the history of changing institutional forms and understandings. So familiarity with traditions is one resource of great value in understanding and interpreting Scripture. What people have said before us, what they're saying today, constitutes the changing kaleidoscope of interpretations. And what of experience? People often treat certain events in their lives through memories they value and regularly mark those events through rituals. Infant baptism, which is practiced in Methodism along with a number of other denominations, although not something a person ordinarily consciously remembers, is an initiation into the community of faith. When buffeted by many threats and dangers from multiple sources, it is said that Martin Luther regularly uttered the words, "Martin, you are a baptized man." And he reported the strength that gave him courage from reminding himself regularly of that fact. The other sacrament practices Methodism, also as in many other Protestant communities, is Holy Communion, often called the Lord's Supper. Part of many versions of that liturgy include the words, "Do this in remembrance of me." There's a long history of debate about the Eucharist and the sacraments that is caught up in one side of that debate in those words, "Do this in remembrance of me." Among its multi-layered meanings in this ritual is surely a regular reminder of participating in a community that regards Jesus as a trustworthy teacher of how life can be meaningful and sustaining. Birthday celebrations, wedding anniversaries, graduation parties, etc., are other common rituals in which we participate, which add meaning to our lives. More generally, what do we mean by the term experience? Well, one ordinary way we use the word is to credit someone with having accumulated sufficient knowledge and information and understanding as to say of her, she is an experienced person. But yet another connotation of the word experience is to encounter or endure something as, for instance, an ordeal, or beauty, or a mystery that lies outside the ordinary, daily, taken-for-granted world. What an experience. And I also propose that experience is a sufficiently elastic term as to convey that we characterize someone's experience. When we characterize someone's experience, we sometimes mean that he or she is not thrown off stride or stress when some unprecedented, extraordinary event occurs, which is completely new, utterly unanticipated. In that sense, experience can mean and be understood as openness to what comes at one and to one in the course of life. Freedom to be prepared for the unexpected with grace and courage and trust. Being an experienced person in this sense is being able to incorporate newness in one's life. Many years ago, I attended a lecture by an extraordinary poet, a man named John Ciardi. After he had reflected on the power of poetry to open up new awareness, new sensibility, appreciation of beauty, given expression through words that exceed our knowledge and understanding, he shifted gears and made this comment: "I don't understand my wife, but my, what an experience." And reflectively he added, "And I'm going to go home and tell her so." Experience can take us into realms beyond our previous knowledge and understanding. And that recognition is the mark of an experienced person, in my view. So what of the fourth reason? Any serious exploration of what it means to be a human includes recognizing that we are endowed with reason. We're challenged to use it creatively, diligently, extensively. We're the heirs of traditions that are rich repositories from which we can learn, if we are open to them. We regularly have experiences that transcend and transform our lives and lead to creative new insights. We're fortunate to be participants in a faith community that challenges us to explore scriptures, not just the Bible, with these resources of tradition, experience, and reason. Let us never shrink from the challenge to decide what we believe, but then let us be prepared to decide differently again and again. As we change, as we have transformative experiences, that in the words of the hymn we're about to sing today, quote, "make ancient goods, ancient truths, uncouth." It's not only the fact that we do change, it's that we must change. In so doing, we demonstrate the wisdom of calling upon scripture, tradition, experience, and reason. Please ponder today these two comments. First, the one from Charles Wesley with which I began. Let us unite the two so long divided. Knowledge and human piety and vital piety. And the second, far less known, I think, among most of us, from John Wesley. When I was young, I was sure of everything. In a few years, having been mistaken 1,000 times, I was not half so sure of most things as I was before. At present, I'm hardly sure of anything. That acknowledgement underscores one final thought. We are finite, limited beings which is but one interpretation at least, of the doctrine of original sin that is so important in Christian history. Immanuel Kant put it this way: out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. Drawing one inference from that, the New York Times columnist David Brooks, whom I read with from time to time amazement at his audacity and other times deep in appreciation for his insights, he recently reports a quotation from Oscar Wilde: in love's service, there can only be wounded soldiers. Courage and humility are the hallmarks of wounded soldiers. Thank you.